Great emails from a lot of people loving Jocko Willink talking about leadership strategy. So we'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM and take your phone calls. So stand by. Welcome back. Jocko Willink with us. Jocko, can a poor leader sink a company, a family, whatever?
Absolutely. Leadership is the most important thing on the battlefield, and if someone is a bad leader, they can absolutely bring down any team, any organization, any family, for sure.
And you know what's funny about this, too, is most of the rank and file, the tough folks out there who works and work to get this done, they know if they've got a good leader or not, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. People can judge other people. We're all human beings, and just because someone doesn't have senior rank inside of an organization doesn't mean that they lack humanity, right? They can judge and tell when someone's a good leader, someone's a bad leader, for sure. And they can also tell when someone's telling the truth or not. And that's why, as a leader, telling truth to people is so important. And a lot of times, once again, if you let your ego flare up and you think, oh, no one will know that I'm not telling the truth, and they think they can get away with it, the whole team will be looking at them thinking, you're lying to us, we don't trust you. And that, once again, is the beginning of a downfall of a leader and a team.
What do you think the greatest trait of a good leader might be?
The greatest trait for a leader to have is and this is counterintuitive, but it's humility. It's being humble. Mm-hmm. And people think, oh, someone's a leader, they need to be this bold person that barks out orders. Not true. Actually, the most important characteristic is humility, and it's the subject we've been talking about all night. If I think I know everything, I don't listen to anybody else. I can't improve, and I don't respect my enemy, or I don't respect my competitor because I think I'm better than them. And you can see all those things wrapped around ego will bring failure to a leader and to a team. But if you're humble, you listen, you pay attention, you respect your competitors, you respect your enemy, you do a good job. That's why it's the most important characteristic for a leader to have, humility.
Let's go to the phones. We're going to go to Cornelius in Louisiana. And first, we have to congratulate him on his LSU national champs. You have got to be going crazy tonight.
Go Tigers! George.
You loved it. What a game, huh?
What a game, George. I told Barry, see, Barry and I, he was for the Clemson Tigers. I was for the LSU Tigers. So one of the Tigers had to win. And I'm glad LSU won. My prediction came through. Jocko, I wanted to say this. Now, if you look at the LSU Tigers, Coach Orgeron wasn't supposed to be the coach of that team. Joe Burrow wasn't supposed to come to Louisiana. But everything just meshed. And I thought Clemson was going to win because when they first started out, they started out rough. But they got together, and that's what teamwork can do. So, George, God bless you. San Francisco's going to win the Super Bowl.
You may be right about that, too. Team leadership, Jocko.
No doubt. Most important thing on the battlefield is leadership.
The St. Louis Blues last year were dead last a couple months before the Stanley Cup hockey team finals, and they ended up winning the Stanley Cup. Their coach put them together with something, some kind of magic, and they ended up winning the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, that's once again, leadership's the most important thing on the battlefield, and we've been talking a little bit about bad leaders and how that can make a team fail, but yes, good leadership, great leadership can turn teams around and have them win championships.
Can a good leader make average people perform way beyond their expectations?
Yeah, and more important than that, you know, on a team, the sum is greater than the parts. So, first of all, the individuals will perform better than they would normally perform if they're working for a good leader, and then you combine them with other people that are stepping up their game, and that's when you get exponential improvement inside of an organization.
Joe in the Bronx, welcome to the program. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good, my friend.
I had a chance to wish you a happy new year. I wish you a happy, healthy new year.
Good. I hope everything's well with you.
Thank you. Yes, it is. And Jocko, you're a great guest. I wanted to know, what is the most important strategy that one can implement when bringing a new product to market? And as far as implementing ideas into action, what is your opinion of that, the approach and the strategy?
So if you're bringing a new product to market, one of the most important things that a person needs to do is actually listen to feedback that you get. So, you know, we come up with a product in our minds and we think it's the way we want it and it's what we want and it's the way it should be in our minds. And so when we bring it to market, all of a sudden we look around and no one's buying our product. And instead of saying, well, maybe we need to adjust our product, we think, what's wrong with everyone? How come they don't love my product? What you need to do, talking about humility seems to be the theme of the night. What is my product? What do I need to change about my product? What do I need to change about my marketing? What am I doing wrong that I can improve this where people want it more? And then as far as rolling out ideas amongst a team, one of the best ways to roll out ideas in a team is actually to plant seeds of those ideas with the team and let the team come up with the ideas. Plant the seeds, give them some suggestions, but let them really, really grow the ideas so the team feels like the ideas are theirs, and they are. They, you know, you give them a little seed, but they're going to really have ownership of that plan, and they'll execute it with much more tenacity because it came from them.
And a good leader, Jocko, knows his market, knows his demographics, knows who to go after when you're trying to market or sell something.
Yeah, no, I mean, when I would start talking to companies and I'd start talking to sales teams inside of companies, and I would do a kind of I'd be talking about their product and I'd kind of pitch their product to them. And they'd say, wow, that was great. I'm surprised you never did sales. Well, when you're in a leadership position, you're constantly trying to sell ideas up and down the chain of command. You know, my team would come up, my platoon would come up with a plan for an operation. I would actually have to sell that idea up the chain of command to my boss to get approval. So, yeah, salesmanship is very important as a leader. And what does that mean? It means you communicate to them. It means you make them understand what your vision is, and you do a good job of that. You articulate it well, just like a salesperson would do. You and the best type of salespeople are the people that tell you the truth about what's going on. You build trust with them. You listen to them. They're doing something that's going to benefit you, and it all turns out good for both sides in the end. And that's the same thing with being a leader.
Baseball coach Leo Durocher once said, nice guys finish last. Do you believe that?
No, I don't really believe that, actually. You know, do you have to be aggressive sometimes? Yes, you do. But if you're actually one of the premier underpinnings of a good leader is that you care about your team, that you actually want to take care of your team, that the people on your team are more important than you are. So being a nice person and taking care of the people around you, if you take care of the people on your team, they are going to take care of you. And that means they're going to take care of the mission. That means they're going to take care of their job. If you don't care about them, they're not going to care about you. They're not going to do their job well. They're not going to execute their mission. So I think that's wrong.
First-time caller Tom in Minnesota. Take it away, Thomas.
Hi. Hello.
Hi there.
I run a concrete company, and I just had a question about employees that would be challenging you and just looking for tips. If you're being challenged as a leader, as you know, in the concrete industry, there's many ways to do the work. It's just the end result to get the best product. And any tips on when you have an employee challenging you?
And when you say challenge, are they challenging you to make you look bad, or they just want answers? What are they trying to accomplish?
Like, as far as how the work would be done, or
Are they questioning you?
Right.
Okay. What do you think, Jocko?
Yeah, I actually love it when people on my team question me. And one of the best methods to overcome that is, you know, Tom, if you were working for me and I gave you, you know, instructions on how I want this concrete poured, and you said, hey, Jocko, I think we should do it this way. You know what I'd actually say? You know, okay, Tom, you know, if you want to do it that way, here's some things to look out for. I used to do it that way, and it doesn't always work. Here's some pitfalls, but if you want to give it a try, go for it. Let's do it. Now, obviously, if you're doing a massive pour and there's a lot of risk, that might not be the time to do it. But if you've got something where you can take a little bit of risk on a job and you say, okay, you want to run this thing the way you want to run it? Let's see how it works out. And you know, especially if it's something easy where, hey, maybe it's going to take him, like, you know that your method you could get done in 2 or 3 hours, and this other guy's method that's giving you pushback, it's going to take him 5 hours. Okay, cool. Let him do it his way. Let him have ownership of that. And then you can discuss it and say, hey, I gave you a try. You can see that took a long time. Maybe, and also if you keep a true open mind, Maybe there's some things in the methods that he used that actually were better. And if that happens, great, adopt them for the whole team. So just when people are pushing back, try and listen to them. And I can know it can be frustrating, especially if you have more experience and maybe they're not going to do things the most efficient way. It's okay. Let them learn a little bit along the way, and they'll be, again, you're in doing this, you're actually giving them respect, listening to them, allowing them to influence you, and that means they're going to allow you to influence them more, they're going to respect you more, and it should work out well in the end.
And nothing wrong, Jocko, with them trying to show you as the leader, the boss, a better way.
Nothing wrong at all. I love it.
Tom, good luck. Thanks. Good question. Let's go next to Jeff in Santa Rosa, California. Jeffrey, take it away.
Hey, George. Jocko. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. I have a brief comment and then my question. My comment was that what you're describing or what you've written in your books is what Omar Bradley described as military management. And he said that Dwight Eisenhower, the supreme commander of the Allied forces, was a better diplomat than he was a military manager. My question is the following. How does what you've written mesh up with the 1963 or maybe it was a 1964 version of the English translation of Sun Tzu, The Art of War, which is the most accurate version that I've found?
Well, I actually have a podcast where I review military books from all of history. I've absolutely, Sun Tzu, Art of War was one of the earlier ones I did, and everything that I talk about breaks down, you know, and aligns very well with the prominent theories of war throughout history. Because when you take human beings, you put them in a leadership position, and you send them into war, if they are able to get through that successfully, they're going to come to very similar conclusions. And that's what happened to me and the theories that I use. And when I look at texts like Sun Tzu, there's a very clear alignment across the board.
Okay, good luck. Jocko, since you've been doing this, and how many years have you been doing this? Did you do it when you got out of the Navy?
Yes, so I retired in 2010, and I immediately was doing this.
What was it that you saw? You obviously saw a void. What was that?
Well, I knew a guy that was the CEO of a big company, and he asked me to come and talk to his executive team about leadership. And I went up there, I talked to his team, and when I got done, he came up to me and said, I want you to talk to every division in my company. So I started talking, going around the country, talking to all the divisions in his company. And at one of those divisional meetings, the CEO of the parent company was there. And as soon as I got done giving a brief, he came up to me and said, I want you to come and talk to all my CEOs. And when I went and talked to all of the CEOs, then a bunch of these, he owned like 45 or 50 companies, a bunch of them came up to me and asked me to come and talk to their companies. So what I realized, the first thing I realized was that the leadership principles that I had learned throughout my career, the leadership principles that are, once again, aligned with historic leadership, military leadership across the ages, that these apply not just in military situations, but in any situation where a human being is leading other human beings to accomplish a mission.
Next up, we go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Hey, Joseph, take it away.
Hey, Jocko, two quick questions. First of all, like you were talking about Blockbuster with the shifts, and I guess in the Navy you have to look at shifts and see, but I don't think there's too much emphasis in management courses, et cetera, on identifying shifts. And I think it's not just hubris or arrogance. It's just that people aren't taught to identify shifts. And my second question would be more of a personal type of thing, where, okay, I've run some marathons, and, you know, how do I gauge my performance? Do I do it relative to how I used to do, to people that are faster? Obviously, I'm not going to gauge myself relative to the people at the very top. So how would you look at something like, say, writing an article or a book? How would you gauge your relative performance?
Well, let's start with the first question about when shifts occur. You're right that it might not necessarily be around ego, and there's times where inside of organizations what we do is we get busy with the tactical fight that's going on right now. We get busy with the sales numbers this week, this month, and we stop looking to the long-term future. So, yes, that can absolutely happen, and that might not necessarily be related to ego, other than the fact that if you don't think you need to pay attention to shifts in the environment, shifts in the battlefield, shifts in the market, then that's going to be a problem. So, yeah, it might not necessarily be ego, but we need to be cognizant that shifts can occur, and we need to assign people. You know, in the military, we have a person that's called operations inside of a SEAL team, and you also have a person that's called future operations, that's looking ahead. So we have to pay attention to what could happen in the future. As far as how you judge yourself, I always look at if I'm a leader, I want to see how I'm doing. The number one thing I look at is how is my team doing? Are we accomplishing the mission or not? If we're accomplishing the mission and we're doing it effectively and we're doing it efficiently, then I figured I'm doing a good job. This doesn't mean I'm perfect. I'm still going to look to improve things. But if my team is not performing its job and we're not executing our mission, then guess what? I know the problem is me, and I've got to start to make some adjustments in the way I'm leading so that we do start to succeed.
Can you be a good leader and not succeed? That's an interesting question.
You could come up to a mission tasking or a project that is not possible to do. Now, what a good leader is going to do is identify, you know, at a certain point, and you say, look, what we're doing right now is not working. You know, I've got a chapter in this new book. It's called When to Quit. And it's a surprise, you know, it's kind of a surprising thing to hear coming out of someone that spent so much time in the SEAL teams, because a mantra that we have in the SEAL teams is never quit. And it's a great mantra to have. Here's the problem. It works when you're going through training. It works to have that attitude in tough situations. But as a leader, if I'm trying to lead my platoon to assault a target, and the route that we're using to get to the target is heavily contested by the enemy, and we start taking casualties, does that mean I should necessarily just never quit and keep going down that route and keep doing a frontal assault on the target? Not necessarily, because I might lose all of my guys. What I should do is maybe quit that plan, go back, retreat, regroup, and find another way to conduct that assault. So that can happen, where, you know, you come up with a plan, you try and execute a plan, it doesn't work despite your good leadership and despite the team doing what they're supposed to do. You came up with a bad plan. Don't keep going. Don't ride that plan into the ground. What you should do is take a step back, retreat a little bit, regroup, so you can reengage and reattack.
Jocko, how do companies that need your services find you?
Go to our website, echelonfront.com.
Simple as that. And I assume word of mouth is out there too, isn't it?
Well, yeah, actually, it's 100% business. That's operated on word of mouth since we started 8 years ago. We never spend any money on advertising. It's 100% word of mouth. Although we do have, you know, I've written the books about leadership, so that obviously, you know, brings in people. And the podcast that I have, I talk about leadership a lot. And so those are the way that the word gets out there, but most of it is just companies talking to other companies, people talking to other people, and talking about the success they've had based on these principles.
Okay, we're going to come back in just a moment with Jocko Willink and take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM with his book, Leadership Strategy and Tactics, a Field Manual. Pretty good read, by the way. Very important. Next hour, Beyond Ever After, a heart-to-heart journey through death and the afterlife with Jocelyn Montanaro and Catherine Weisenberg. They will be joining us as we talk about their incredible journey. Next hour, of course, when we talk to both of them, they will be in two separate areas. So we'll be talking to Jocelyn first, then Catherine, and then we'll bring them both back for phone calls. Speaking of calls, we're going to come back and wrap things up with our special guest, Jocko Willink, in just a moment as we talk about his work dealing with, of course, leadership strategy, and tactics. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, back with our final segment with Jocko Willink as we talk about his work, leadership strategy, and tactics. What would you say, Jocko, has been one of your favorite success stories when you've come into an organization and you saw them actually listen to you, apply it, and make it work?
We get to see that all the time and see companies just really turn themselves around. I think one that stands out in particular to me was working with a very big company and went in, and it was actually, I did about a 6-hour workshop with them. And, you know, that was what they could schedule. So I went in, I talked to them, we kind of broke some stuff down. I had a great day of training with them. And then they kind of continued on their way. They were a very busy company. And it turns out I went to work with a different company in the same area, and I stopped by to see them. You know, I'd maintained communication with the CEO, and so I was texting back and forth with him over the next, it was about a year. And I show back up a year later, and when I walk into the office, everyone's kind of high-fiving me and all excited. And then I see the CEO, and the CEO was he came out, gave me a big hug. He'd lost like 50 pounds. He started working out. They put a gym inside of their facility, and they had doubled their revenues in a year. And this was already a company that was doing really well. So that's one that sticks in my mind, just because, you know, the CEO, from a leadership perspective, from a personal perspective, the company, the team, everything was just incredibly, had improved incredibly. So that was great to see.
It must be exciting for you to see that happen.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. When you get that kind of feedback, it's amazing to get that kind of feedback, you know, from emails, from, you know, people send me, you know, what their revenue sheets look like, what their P&L, what their stock price has done. They'll send those kind of things to me, and that's always great. I've written a bunch of kids' books too, and the kids' books that I've written are you know, helping kids overcome kind of common problems that kids have. And that's another neat thing, is getting feedback from kids and then teaching the same principles to kids. But getting feedback from kids that they did their first pull-up, that they got an A on a math test, those kind of things. So that kind of feedback is always great to have from companies, from leaders, and even from kids.
Do you get many companies talking about the war in Iraq or anything like that?
You know, I'll get asked an occasional question, but we don't really present things from a political viewpoint.
No,
we present stories that are from Iraq, but they're not based on the political environment. They're based on the leadership that we saw out on the battlefield. So we're pretty apolitical when it comes to working with clients, and therefore we don't get a ton of questions, you know, political questions about what's going on.
Did you grow to like most of the Iraqi people?
Yeah, I mean, Iraqi people, and this is one thing that I do explain when I talk to folks about the war in Iraq, is that the normal Iraqi people that live there, and you try and understand what a normal Iraqi family is like, and the easiest way to explain what a normal Iraqi family is like is to say that the normal Iraqi family is pretty much like a normal American family. And we'd go into a compound with a house where someone lives, and there'd be, you know, a dad in there that would be working on a car, and there'd be a mom that would be cooking lunch, and there'd be a couple kids kicking a soccer ball around. And if you were to ask that guy what, you know, if you were to ask the father, say, what's your goal in life, he wasn't going to say it was jihad, and he wasn't going to say it was an Islamic State. What he would say is, oh, you know, my goal is to put a room on the back of the house, so when it gets hot in the summertime, the kids have somewhere to play. They're just normal people that are trying to live their lives. And when we were there, they were trying to live their lives amidst these heinous insurgents, these savage insurgents that were there torturing, murdering, raping these locals. And they did not want those insurgents in that country. And they loved our presence and were supportive of what we were trying to do.
Amazing. Let's go to Tom in La Jolla. Welcome to the program, Thomas. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call, and blessings to you, the staff, and, of course, to the entire Coast community. And Commander Willink, I'm deeply appreciative and grateful for your wisdom and analysis. Thank you. Thank you for your service. And a comment and then a question. The comment is, during World War II, the one general that the German military hierarchy were truly afraid of was General George Patton. And they weren't afraid of Bradley or Eisenhower or Montgomery. you know, et cetera. It was patent. And, you know, when you look at the accounts of George Patton running, you know, being leader to the Third Army, it seemed that his virtue was not his charisma. His virtue was that he always bypassed the chain of command. And he even wrote about this in his diary, you know, that if you want to truly know what's going on, you have to ask the privates. And there were innumerable stories of privates, you know, there might be a private trying to fix a truck, and all of a sudden Patton climbs underneath the engine block with oil splattering on his uniform, and he's asking, what's going on, soldier? And why is this truck not working? And what can I do to support you? And there were other incidents, again, not just one or two or three accounts, but innumerable accounts of privates being consulted by Patton because he bypassed his chain of command to find out what was really going on the battlefield. And I was wondering if you would comment on that strategy by Patton and maybe on Patton himself.
Well, this is a strategy that I absolutely use, you know, and it's a term. Well, first of all, I got a section in this new book where the section is called Picking Up Brass. And what that's about is, you know, when you go out in a SEAL platoon and you go out and train, you shoot a bunch of weapons, and the shell casings, the brass shell casings, are all over the desert. And I'm talking square miles of terrain. And guess what? That stuff has to be picked up, and it has to be recycled, and it just needs to be cleaned up. You can't leave brass all over your ranges. So you have to go out there on your hands and knees and pick up brass. And it's pretty easy for a platoon commander to say, hey, I've got a meeting back at our headquarters. I'm going to leave. And when you do that, it's everything that you just talked about, finding out what's going on with the guys seeing that you're humble enough to be out there picking up the brass. I always stayed and picked up the brass with the guys. Very similar in the way that, and I'm not comparing myself to George Patton by any stretch, but that is an attitude that I took as well, which was, I'm going to go ahead and be there with the boys, because not only so you're helping out, not only so they see that you're, you know, not above doing the hard work, but also so that you learn more about them and you hear straight from the horse's mouth what's going on. I've got another little section about Patton in here. One of Patton's, as you know, I'm sure, Tom, one of Patton's sayings was, never dig in, right? We're not going to dig in. We're going to advance. And that's a great attitude to have when you're talking about it from a tactical perspective. But the way I talk about it in the book is not only from a tactical perspective, but from a leadership perspective. I talk about not digging in to defend your ideas. So if I come up with a plan on how we're going to execute something, and then, Tom, you come to me with a different plan, instead of me digging in and saying, no, my plan is right, your plan is wrong, when I dig in, it leaves me no space to maneuver. And when would it possibly be good to put yourself in a situation where you can't maneuver? Well, when you dig in, you can't maneuver. So I'm a huge fan of Patton. War as I Knew It, great book that he wrote. And, you know, I try to learn lessons from him all the time. So thanks for the feedback, Tom.
You knew the American sniper, Chris Kyle.
So Chris Kyle was, so I was the commander of something called SEAL Team 3 Task Unit Bruiser, which is two SEAL platoons combined together. I was the overall individual in charge. I was the commander. And then in those two SEAL platoons, the two SEAL platoons were Charlie Platoon and Delta Platoon. And Chris Kyle was the lead sniper and point man in Charlie Platoon. And the bulk of the work that he did as a sniper in the SEAL teams, he did with us during the Battle of Ramadi.
Quite a guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, great guy, phenomenal guy. Very one thing that they don't really portray about him very well, for instance, in the movie, is he's actually a real funny guy. He was a prankster, very gregarious, always having a good time. You know, they made him kind of this solemn character.
Oh, very straight, wasn't he?
Right. He was a riot. He was a riot to be around.
Tragic death.
Indeed.
Joe in Boston, take it away. Hi, Joseph.
good morning, Jocko. Glad to speak with you. I agree and disagree with George. I have a comment and a few questions. I hope first you get your book on audio because I'm blind. What do you think, and I know most people don't act, how do you make people be responsible like politicians and doctors? When you go to a hospital or medical teams, they have you sign a waiver because a few of my friends have been killed by mistakes. You really ought to speak to the politicians and stuff like this. And I wanted to say, I hope, and I really sincerely as a blind person hope we get out of these countries. They don't want us in there, that soldier that shot those people at the airbase. We help all the people, and they don't like us, the Saudis. We should pull out and teach the Iraqis, and I agree, how to, like you teach your kids, they have to live their life. You can't live it for them. But don't you think, and I hope you agree with me, that we should eventually bring all our troops home? We can't. I know we killed this guy. He was wrong, but we can't police the world. I'd like your comment, and make your phone available easier on your website. Someday I'll give you a call and tell you what I've been through. I haven't been as lucky. We can't get help from medical. It's terrible what goes on.
All right, Joe. All right. Keep it to the topic at hand.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where I think we have to be careful about taking extreme views. And to Joe's point, should we be the world police out there, you know, constantly deploying troops all over the world to solve other people's problems? No, that's not a good idea, and people need to learn to defend themselves. The other hand, do we want to just stay inside the borders of our own country while the world kind of falls apart around us? No, that's not good either. You have to be very, very selective and deliberate when you go into another country. And, you know, I talk about war. When I talk about war and going to war, I talk about the fact that when you go to war, you have to have the will to go to war. And what does that mean more specifically? When I talk about the will to go to war, it means you better have the will to kill. And when I say the will to kill, this is very harsh, but when you go to war, you are going to kill people. That's what's going to happen. And this is even harsher. When you go to war, you're going to kill innocent people. There's going to be collateral damage. Anyone that doesn't understand that is being naive. When you go to war and you shoot guns and you drop bombs, innocent people are going to die. And you have to be willing to do that. Look, America goes through incredible lengths to prevent it, but it's still going to happen. So you have to have that will. And the other side of this coin is that when you go to war, you have to be willing to die. American kids are going to get killed. Thinking that you can go to war and not have any casualties is also naive. So before you go and enter into a war, into a conflict, you better make sure that it is worth those incredibly heavy prices. And that is that innocent people are going to die, and American soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines are going to die. So you better make sure, you better make damn sure that the cause you're going in for, into a country to fight, is worth those sacrifices.
Jocko, we haven't talked a lot about women and leadership, and I'm sure they are just as important.
Well, yeah, and we work with, you know, males, females. It doesn't really matter to us. And sometimes people say, well, what about a female leader? Or what is it like, what's when you're leading females, what's the difference? And quite frankly, look, good leaders, regardless of their race, their sex, their background, their religion, it doesn't matter. Good leaders have the same traits. They're humble. They listen. They treat people with respect. They take ownership of failures and mistakes when they happen. They pass credit for success down the chain of command and up the chain of command. They work hard. They have integrity. They're balanced. They're decisive. Good leadership is good leadership, and I've worked with some phenomenal leaders that, male, female, doesn't matter. Leadership is leadership.
Is leadership developed as a child?
I think, you know, our entire personalities are developed as children. As we grow up, we're influenced. You know, I got another chapter in the book about nature or nurture. Which one is it? And the answer is it's both. You know, we have some skills that we get. We got some other skills that we improve. We got some skills that we lack. And like I said earlier, if you lack some skills, then get some people on your team that actually have those skills.
Jocko, once again, thank you for serving our country, my friend, and good luck and more success to you, okay?
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Jocko Willink, his book, Leadership Strategy and Tactics. His first book is called Extreme Ownership, Discipline Equals Freedom. Up next, we are going to be talking about the afterlife, beyond ever after. Two special guests. Our first will be Jocelyn Montanaro. The second guest will be Catherine Weisenberg. And then they will both join us for phone calls in our last hour here on Coast to Coast AM. So get ready for a heart-to-heart journey through death and the afterlife right here on Coast to Coast AM with two special guests, Beyond Ever After. We shall be right back.